Should we go to war? This question not only preoccupies policymakers and the public today, but also did on the eve of the Good War. Lynn Olson is here to talk about her new book, Those Angry Days.
The conservatives basically thought it was going to be bad for business, that we should just stay out and let the Europeans deal with it themselves.
What's the D.C. scalp stare? Since when do senators need to self-brand? And who throws the best parties or funerals in Washington? Mark Leibovich is here to talk about his new D.C. tell-all, This Town.
There's no such thing as Democrats or Republicans so much as millionaires now, and people are doing very, very well there while the rest of the country suffered.
Julie Bosman will join us with notes from the field, and Greg Coles has the bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview.
Lynn Olson is the author of Those Angry Days, Roosevelt, Lindbergh, and America's Fight Over World War II, 1939 to 1941. And she is appropriately calling in from Washington. Welcome to the show, Lynn.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
So your book is reviewed on our cover this week, which looks at several books about the controversies over entering World War II. Now, today, with we look at this as the Good War, and we forget that it was such a huge controversy. Can you talk a little bit about what that period was like?
You're absolutely right. We think of World War II now as the war in which this whole country was united, and it was once we actually got into the war. But in the years leading up to Pearl Harbor, there was a very bitter, passionate fight in the United States about whether to go to the aid of Britain, which was the last country standing against Hitler in Europe, and also whether we should get into the war ourselves. I mean, you know, we look back now and we see the evil and the danger of Hitler and Nazi Germany, but back then it wasn't that clear, especially in the United States. We had a history, basically, of being an isolationist country, and the great majority of Americans from 1939 really until late 1940 really didn't think we should get involved in that war.
Now, was some of this sort of a vestige of World War I and its aftermath?
Absolutely. I mean, we did enter World War I late in the war. The president then, Woodrow Wilson, said we were doing that in order to make the world safe for democracy. Up to that point, basically, the U.S. had stayed out of the European disagreements, the European wars. And Americans rallied behind Wilson and entered the war thinking that, in fact, the world was going to be a better place as a result. And that didn't turn out to be true. I mean, basically, it didn't make the world safe for democracy. It basically helped Hitler come to power. And Americans were very disillusioned by what happened. And they basically felt that we shouldn't get involved in another European conflict again.
Well, let's talk about isolationists at that time. This was a disparate group, but who were the sort of major players in the isolationist camp?
The isolationists really came from, they were conservatives, they were liberals. Basically, they believed that the United States was far better off tending to its own problems, making itself safe from invasion, but that we simply shouldn't get involved. The liberals basically thought that we were going to lose all the social reforms that had happened as a result of the Roosevelt administration, the New Deal, that if we entered the war, the U.S. would become far more conservative, there would not be any emphasis on social justice anymore, that it would become kind of a country that didn't value civil freedoms. The conservatives basically thought it was going to be bad for business, that we should just stay out and let the Europeans deal with it themselves.
So, of course, they were both wrong in their own ways.
They were both wrong, as it turned out. Yes, exactly. They didn't think they were, but they all were.
There were some other interesting subgroups in the isolationist camp, as it were, the Congress of American Mothers. Tell us a little bit about them.
Yeah, you know, it was really interesting, the role that women played in this lead up to World War II, or our involvement in World War II. There was a group of women throughout the country. They were basically conservative. They insisted that the war would be bad for families, that their sons should not be sent off to war, and they made it a very much of a gender-specific thing. They were very active. They were quite influential. They came to Washington in huge numbers.
Dressed in black, right?
Dressed in black, all dressed in black, to lobby Congress to stay out of the war. And they were very much in your face. I mean, you know, they hanged, for example, the effigy of a senator who was very much in favor of helping Britain and getting into the war.
This is Claude Pepper.
Claude Pepper, yes, Senator Claude Pepper from Florida, and they hanged this straw stuffed effigy from the from a tree outside of the Capitol.
And then on the other end, you had the New York's Century Association, the Centurions.
Yeah, they were on the other side. One of the things about my book, one of the things in the research about my book that really surprised me was how important a role that regular Americans played, just ordinary Americans played, in this battle. And there were a couple of very strong interventionist organizations that were really lobbying the President and Congress, again, to help Britain and to get into the war. And one of them was a group of men who most of them were members of the Century Club, which is a very exclusive men's then.
Right.
Men's
still exists.
Yes, it still exists. Now it's open to both men and women, but back then it was a men's club. And they were really the movers and shakers in New York. They were journalists. They were, Wall Street bankers. They really felt that it was absolutely vital for the U.S. To help Britain survive and then to get into the war. And they made no bones about it. And because of their influence, particularly the journalists among the group, they had a very key and critical role in the steps that Roosevelt took to help England and then, basically to save them.
And on the other side, then, you have, of course, the other major figure in your book, Charles Lindbergh.
Charles Lindbergh was really the unofficial leader of the isolationists. I found it so interesting that the two most famous men in America, FDR and Lindbergh, were basically the leaders of the opposite sides in this fight. Lindbergh, of course, made his name by flying solo across the Atlantic in 1927, and he never really lost his popularity because of his stature as a great hero in this country. He really was able to persuade a lot of Americans that we should that we should stay out of the war. That under no circumstances should we get into the war.
And what did he ground this in? I mean, what was his argument?
He and his family had spent a number of years in Europe in the mid to late 30s, after his son was kidnapped and killed. During that time, he spent a lot of time in Germany, had been invited there by the German government, who saw him as an important person to persuade that Germany was unbeatable, in this war that was coming very soon. And he was persuaded, and he was incredibly impressed by the German military, thought they could not be beaten in a war, and basically told the European nations, Britain, France, and the United States, that they should stay out of it, that there should be a negotiated peace with Germany, that basically Germany should be allowed to have whatever it wanted, but that under no circumstances should the U.S. get into the war.
Things changed, of course, at an America First rally that took place in September 1941, where Lindbergh spoke. Tell us about that.
Well, America First was the most influential isolationist organization. Lindbergh actually stayed away from it for a while. He was a very independent-minded person. He did not like to be part of organizations. But actually, in 1941, he did get involved in America First. And he delivered a speech in September 1941, which basically all but destroyed his own influence and the influence of America First in the debate. And in that speech, he made some rather anti-Semitic remarks. He accused American Jews of being kind of a force for war, that they wanted to get into war. And he basically painted American Jews as the other, you know, that they were not, he basically said they were un-American, that they were not, they were more interested in what was happening to Jews in Europe than the future of America. It was just caused an enormous reaction in this country, a huge criticism of him. And he basically was finished, actually, in terms of his influence.
Did that event fundamentally change the argument over whether or not to enter the war?
Well, you know, by that time, by September 1941, the American public opinion had pretty much come around to the idea that we needed to get into the war, that we would have to get into the war. It was a huge sea change over those 2 years. I think the Lindbergh speech just put kind of the icing on the cake. I think that was it for a lot of people when he said that. You know, we got into the war only 3 months later. Basically, I think the force of isolationism was finished at that time.
Do you see any parallels today in terms of the arguments that we have over whether to engage in a foreign conflict?
You know, I think they're very different. In some ways they are similar because it is the same argument that we've been having really since the United States first began. But our position now and our position then is so totally different because we are in the world. I mean, we are the leading power of the world. Back then, we were the leading economic power. We hadn't taken our place really in terms of politically as, you know, as the guiding force in the world. But we are there now. I mean, the question about war now and war then, it's always going to be a debate, but we can't really get away from it, you know. We have to, we are in it. We cannot step back, as some people say, and just relinquish our position in the world. That can't be done.
All right. Well, so the arguments continue, albeit in different ways. Thanks so much, Lynn.
Thank you, Pamela.
The book is Those Angry Days, Roosevelt, Lindbergh, and America's Fight Over World War II, 1939 to 1941, by Lynn Olson, author of several books about World War II and, in particular, America's relationship with England.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is The Boys in the Boat, Nine Americans and Their Epic Quest for Gold at the 1936 Berlin Olympics by Daniel James Brown. That's The Boys in the Boat, and it's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview. That's audible.com/bookreview.
Julie Bosman joins us with Notes from the Field. Julie, what's happening out there?
This week, J.K. Rowling has given us some new information about her latest book, The Cuckoo's Calling.
This is like J.K. Rowling, the series, and we're now on the second book, right?
Yes. Well, this is the second book that she has written for adults. But this is the book that was written under a pseudonym, Robert Galbraith. And J.K. Rowling did not originally intend to be revealed as the author of this book. But last week, she was outed.
Now, there was a lot of controversy about that, right? Because not everyone was convinced that it was an accident.
That's right. It was a very mysterious thing. This book came out in April. It was a detective novel written by someone who was identified as a military man who was out of the military but had written a book with a lot of information about the military in the UK. And it was revealed on Twitter that J.K. Rowling was the author of this book.
Then there was a lot of speculation about who was the secret tweeter, and we've now uncovered that part of the story.
Yes, we know now that it was a law firm that was working for her that revealed that she was the author of this book, and that was one of its partners told the best friend of his wife that J.K. Rowling had written this book under a pseudonym.
So the person wasn't actually an employee of the law firm, but the leak generated.
That's right.
Now, what I like the part of this is about how she picked her pseudonym.
Yeah, so this week, the latest development in this story is that she has gone onto this website that was developed for the book. I believe it's robertgalbraith.com. And she wrote in an extensive Q&A about why she wrote the book, why she chose the pseudonym that she did. And this was a lot of details that, you know, was catnip for her fans because she never really explains a lot about what she does and why she did it. So she said, first of all, that she chose the pseudonym that she did, Robert Galbraith, because of one of her heroes, Robert F. Kennedy. And she chose the last name because of a name that when she was a little girl, she always wanted her name to be Ella Galbraith. She said she has no idea where this came from. She's never met anyone with that last name. And she briefly considered using the pseudonym L. A. Galbraith, using the first two initials, but then decided that that would be too much of a tip-off that it was written by J.K. Rowling.
But then she worried that because there's John Kenneth Galbraith, right, that people would then deduce somehow that it was she who had written the book.
Yes. She was apparently either unaware of the existence of John Kenneth Galbraith, the American economist, of course, who died in 2006, or she just forgot about him. And she realized after it was far too late to change the pseudonym that some people might see it as a tip-off to her real identity. So she said she was very worried about that, but it was too late.
But now everyone's reading into everything, right? Because, I mean, this whole Q&A, it seems, is a response to the fact that there was a lot of suspicion about the timing.
That's right. And she said, just to make it absolutely clear, and I do think that cynics have kind of quieted down about the suspicion that she or someone in her camp leaked the information that she was the author. But she said in this Q&A that having her identity revealed was definitely not part of her plan. And she said that, you know, if anyone had seen the incredibly complex plans that she had drawn up to stay secret, they would have realized just how little she wanted to be discovered.
So it sort of maybe rivals all those plans that she wrote back on napkins long ago about the intricacies of the Harry Potter plot.
Yes. And of course, we now have another novel in this new series, which I think will still be published under her pseudonym that will come out next year.
All right. Well, she's certainly no stranger to sequels. Thank you so much, Julie.
Thank you.
Mark Leibovich is here to talk about his new book, This Town, Two Parties and a Funeral, Plus Plenty of Valet Parking in America's Gilded Capital. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Pamela.
Thanks for being here. So when you think about this title, which I know because you write about it in the book, you considered other titles. It calls to mind other books, of course, most notoriously, You'll Never Eat Lunch in This Town Again.
Yes.
Will you eat lunch in this town again?
I think so. I mean, ultimately, I'm not much of a lunch guy. I mean, I think my favorite lunch dates are the ones that cancel, you know, at the last minute so I can secretly be happy and actually read the paper at my desk for an unforeseen hour. But yeah, I mean, the response has been pretty amazing. I mean, I think a lot of people have been off the record rooting me on. This is actually on the record because we're on tape. But I mean, they have been telling me privately, you know, you got to get this, you got to do this, be as brutal as you can, but I don't want to be associated with it. But yes, I think any time, I mean, Washington is sort of a town in which a neutral sheen of notoriety kind of takes over and people sort of forget whether you've done something wrong or infamous or you've done something disloyal. So I think I will be totally fine.
And for those who aren't familiar, this town is really a Washington expose in the same way that Julia Phillips's book, You'll Never Eat Lunch in This Town Again, kind of cracked open Hollywood. And what you look at really is this close relationship between journalism and politics and money and lobbyists. But everybody has always sort of blamed Washington and characterized Washington in this way. What's changed?
What's changed is, I would say, two things. I mean, one is just there is so much money now. I mean, Washington has always been sort of a baseline economically prosperous community. I mean, on the whole, there's always been a lot of poverty there. But because the federal government's there, they've always been somewhat protected. But in the last 20 years, government's grown a great deal. But just the flood of corporate money, the flood of media money, just the flood of Hollywood money, the flood of tourist money. I mean, it's just become a very, very gilded place. And then the other thing is just the proliferation of new media. I mean, fame has never been so easy. And I think one of the myths about Washington is that it's hopelessly divided. In fact, it's hopelessly interconnected. And ultimately, there's no such thing as Democrats or Republicans so much as millionaires now. And people are doing very, very well there while the rest of the country suffered.
And you have some great scenes at parties where you have these sort of, you know, clusters of media with their sources and, you know, parties where everybody is telling each other, you know, complimenting Twitter feeds and media appearances. Yeah. And you have a couple of really great phrases, Suck Up City. Tell us what that is.
Well, that was a working title for a while. I didn't want my kids saying it because it just seemed a little
My dad
your face.
Just wrote a it's great like, book.
Yeah, they're just too young. Maybe in a few years, that'll be the sequel. No, but I think that was an Obama term or a term that some of Obama's aides used when they were coming in 2008. And everyone was just sucking up to them left and right to get Obama booked on their show or to get jobs or what have you. So I like the term. I think it applies across the board. And I kind of went with it to a point. But again, it's a chapter name and not the ultimate title.
And when they're not sucking up, they're doing what you call the DC scalp stare. What's that?
The DC scalp stare is the act of actually being looked at over your scalp while you're being ostensibly talked to at a party or a meeting or something because someone is looking for someone more important to talk to than just lowly old me.
And importance, it seems, as you mentioned earlier, is really more and more about money. You have some startling statistics in there. What is it, 50% of former senators become registered lobbyists?
Yes, in that ballpark. I think it changes all the time. But yes, about half of senators and congressmen leave office and then they join some kind of lobbying or influence firm. And yeah, it's striking. I mean, the whole notion of coming to Washington, serving a few terms, going back to the farm or wherever is just so quaint because people run against Washington, but really they settle into it like a warm bath and most people wind up staying.
And there are, as you note in your title and throughout the book, a lot of parties, a lot of socializing that goes on in D.C. Tell us about the three kinds of this town parties that you identified.
I would say the three are one that are predominantly young people, sort of the young people who are sniping at those in power. And then there's the ones that's featuring those in power who are secretly worried about the younger people taking their jobs. And then there are the older ones who are always constantly talking about the older sort of guard, former office holders, usually very wealthy by trading on their former titles, talking about how in their day it was so much better. And if things were done in this particular way, as President so-and-so did with me, we wouldn't have all these problems.
But of course, the important question is which parties are the most fun? Which serve the best drinks?
I think it's irrelevant at this point because I think I'll stop being invited. But,
right.
The larger takeaway is that it's just rather decadent. I mean, it's just a very, there's a very when Rome burns, I mean, the king fiddling while Rome burns feel to Washington these days, which I don't think people outside of town fully appreciate and understand.
Now, fitting to the subject, this is a very gossipy, name-droppy book, and you really are very open about the way you observed people behaving in Washington. Have you gotten any feedback yet from some of these people?
When people use the word gossip, which is a fine word because I gossip just as much as anyone, I mean, in my private life, but it is a work of journalism. I mean, I would have published any of this in the New York Times. I mean, maybe I don't, with the editor's blessings. And, I fact-checked it rigorously. I mean, I went over it. I worked on it for 3 years. So
did you go back and sort of ask these people, is it true that you blew off so-and-so at this point?
The fact-checking, I didn't go that level, but the fact-checking process was rather unique and somewhat combative at times. But ultimately, yeah, I mean, I've been yelled at. I mean, most of it's been in the macro, how dare you variety. I mean, you've given away the secret handshake. And I find that amusing because it again, also makes the point. I mean, this is sort of our racket. How dare you give it away? And look, if it makes people uncomfortable, I feel like I've done my job.
Yeah, I mean, the book is very amusing, really fun. But you have a serious point to make here. What do you want readers to take away from this? And I guess also, what do you want people in Washington to take away from reading the book?
Well, I would say that outside of Washington, I think the real serious takeaway is that not only is Washington bad, but here is why it's bad. And that part of it is the interconnectedness of it. Part of it is the money. Part of it is the fact that the division that people see on TV, on cable, on the floors of Congress is ultimately very good business for a lot of key sectors.
And
it's ratings, it's lobbying money, because frankly, if an immigration bill passes tomorrow, you know, tens of millions in lobbying money is going to stop being spent trying to lobby the massive bill, right? So disagreement and division is very good for business in Washington.
For the self-branding,
yes. And that is just rampant today. So I think that that's one important point. And inside of Washington, look, I mean, as a reporter, people are asking me, you know, what are your solutions? Do we need a third party? Do we need term limits? And I honestly don't know, but I try to just hold a mirror to this and hope it, if it brings about change, great.
All right. Well, happy to read about it. Happy not to live there. Thank you so much, Mark, for coming in.
Thanks, Pamela.
Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list this week?
Well, I'm going to take a look at the combined list this week, and there's a lot, so I'll talk fast. New at number one, no real surprise here, the debut mystery by Robert Galbraith.
That nobody.
The Cuckoo's Calling, who we all know now is really J.K. Rowling. That is new at number one. On the hardcover list, it's also selling well, but it didn't quite crack number one. It's new at number three on the hardcover list.
Now, that may have been because there weren't a lot of copies of it available for a while, right? They had to kind of rush to get it into stores.
That's exactly right. And so everyone kind of beat the stores by just downloading it, and that pushed it up to the top of the combined list. What there were copies of, surprisingly, is signed copies. Apparently, Rowling, she didn't sign them at readings or anything, obviously. She was still trying to pass herself off as Robert Galbraith. But she signed a number of copies through the publisher, which the publisher then distributed to various bookstores who specialize in signed first editions and things like that. And once the news broke that Galbraith was really Rowling, the prices on those signed first editions just skyrocketed. And there's a used book website called abebooks.com. They sold a signed first edition last week for $4,450, or something like that. Then at number two on the combined fiction list, we've got a new book by Daniel Silva called The English Girl. This is part of his Gabriel Allen series. Gabriel Allen is an art restorer and a sometimes spy for the Israeli Secret Service. And the big news about that book is that it is number one on the hardcover fiction list, which means it has toppled Dan Brown's Inferno, another book about a kind of art guy, symbologist, Robert Langdon.
Isn't everyone an art restorer slash occasional spy?
Then at number three on the combined fiction list, Danielle Steele's new book, First Sight, also makes its debut. So we have new books in the top three spots on the combined fiction list. At number five, Iris Johansson's Hunting Eve. It's the second book in a trilogy that first cracked the list earlier this year. Then at number 11, there's a book called Alpha Bad Boys. It's got seven different authors. It's actually seven different books by seven different authors, all romance writers. Shayla Black, Lexi Blake, Olivia Cunning, Lisa Renee Jones, Selena Blake, Eliza Gale, and Kat Johnson. They wrote seven books about bad boys and the women who love them. And that, as a package deal, has gone on the combined list at number 11. And then at number 13, Debbie McComber, who writes these romances that often involve knitting, set in Washington State. And this is actually not a novel. It is a short story called Lost and Found in Cedar Cove. And that's one of those weird things that turn up sometimes on the combined list where because you can sell a short story on ebooks and people like it, they buy that, and it pushes it onto the list. But you're really comparing apples and oranges then on the fiction list. You're looking at a short story as opposed to a novel.
Isn't that a TV show now as well?
There is, in fact, a TV show based on her series of books, which are all set in this fictional Washington town of Cedar Cove. The show is called Debbie McComber's Cedar Cove. It is airing, unsurprisingly, on the Hallmark Network, Saturdays at 8. I did want to just mention a couple of books that are on the hardcover fiction list, but not on the combined list. At number 11 on the hardcover list, Terry Brooks has the third book of a new Shannara fantasy trilogy called Witch Wraith. And at number 14, the posthumously published novel in verse, Love, Dishonor, Marry, Die, Cherish, Perish, by David Rakoff, who was a longtime essayist for public radio's This American Life. This is a novel in verse that kind of spans the 20th century, and it's gotten some good attention. On the combined nonfiction list this week, there are six new titles. Again, starting at the very top of the list, the top two titles on the combined nonfiction are both new to the list this week. At number one, it is a book called This Town by the New York Times' own Mark Leibovitz.
And he was, of course, on the podcast earlier today.
Yeah. And at number two, Reza Aslan has a book called Zealot, which is the latest in a long series of books by various authors trying to imagine the life of the historical Jesus as opposed to the Jesus of the Bible. And Aslan does that really by looking at the context of Palestine at that time and the world of Judea, the political context and social context. Then at number six, Matthew Berry, who is a senior fantasy sports analyst for ESPN. Just a great job.
What a great title.
Great title. And he has a book called Fantasy Life, which is all about the world of fantasy sports. I just love that ESPN actually has a show devoted to fantasy sports and analyzing fantasy sports. Then at number 13, and also at number 14 this week, two books that were published in the past that have returned to the list for different reasons. At number 13, it is Born Standing Up by the comedian and author Steve Martin. This is a memoir about his years as a stand-up comedian. It was first published in 2008, and it makes the list now because it was one of these Kindle Daily deals. And then at number 14, another memoir, Orange is the New Black by Piper Kerman. This one was originally published in 2010, and it's returning to the list now because Netflix has just started an original series based on that book. It's about a middle-class woman's stint in prison for drug charges.
So two books propelled onto the list by newcomers in the TV arena.
Yeah. Piper Kerman and Debbie McComber. That's right. And that's it. Those are the titles on the list this week.
All right. Well, thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.